I gotta get every little religion, you know, drought-ridden country, this historical.
Yeah, that's right.
Amos,
that was quite a shock, I imagine, to find the union circle.
What was that?
Amos Fifth, you know, the Central Exchange died here about a month ago. No, less than that.
Well, how come that the early territorial governors were liberal? I mean, they weren't in Minnesota. It was Lincoln?
I don't know whether, I don't know whether you could say our governors were so liberal, but through Lincoln's appointments, a lot of liberal people, and the farmers were liberal.
Well, they were in Minnesota too.
The second governor of North Dakota vetoed a bill in order to permit the farmers to ship their own grain. That is, they passed a bill to force the railroads to grant them sites to build elevators or to furnish cars to farmers. And the second governor of North Dakota vetoed that bill.
Oh.
So they were, and they passed resolutions to build a terminal elevator way back in those days.
Hmm. What kept Dakota from becoming a state so long?
Well, I don't know that.
You know, the Minnesota Constitution split on the question of the Negro suffrage, state constitution.
I didn't hear that.
They split and they had two constitutional conventions, and the left wing wanted Negro suffrage, and they finally had to compromise because they were afraid they would, you know, not get their franchise for a state.
There was an internal fight between the politicians of the southern part of the territory and the north, you know, and that probably had a tendency to retard the statehood. They all wanted the capital. They stole their boys from Bismarck, went down and stole the capital at Yankton one time, brought it up here.
Where'd they bring it to?
Bismarck.
Oh, to Bismarck. It was it where?
Yankton.
Oh, Yankton. Oh, they had in all those territories those fights, but where the capital was going to be. They did the same thing in St. Paul. Those were really quite raucous days.
Yeah.
You don't have a copy of the Constitutional Convention of North Dakota, do you? When Powell spoke, you know, and told them not to plow up North Dakota? This was at the Constitutional Convention.
No, I don't know if I have that. I haven't heard what you mentioned there. I don't remember.
Well, this Powell, he's head of the Department of Interior then, and he was the main speaker, and he made a remarkable speech, you know, telling them to keep control of their water rights and not to plow the land, to keep it in pasturage, and that they would have droughts within 20 years, he said.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a remarkable speech.
I haven't read that. What about that? The only thing I would have on that, I've got a history on North Dakota by the publisher of the Bismarck Tribune, and he notes quite a few things on those days. There might be something like that on it.
I've read a number of histories, but they all seem to be pretty right-wing histories, you know.
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
That's
the only source that I know of to get. Have you seen that history of North Dakota, big history in three volumes?
There's one by Doran Robinson, is that?
No.
Four.
after knowing that the Indians were organizing another uprising in 1863. So Lincoln sent out Sibley from Fort Snelling and Sully from down in Kansas City, I guess you saw it, to meet up here and corral the Indians in 1862 when this battle was fought.
Oh. And who won?
Well, they just messed with the points of Indian hunters. You know.
They just killed them.
Yeah,
that's nice. Terrible history. Is there, are there any Indians around here? No, only Indians here now.
There's no
reservation around here. Well, about 80 miles west of here, Where'd you get this kind of material?
It's been gathered up by different people, and Shimon, the copies of the records that he could found, and Shimon had a voice of it, and I tried to pick up what I could, and he turned his over to me before he died.
Oh.
He was a member of the committee that looks at the battlefield, and I was too.
Oh.
And I have that material, and I was going to make it up in a book so that people could see more of it. I was going to leave it up there at the museum, but before I left it there, I'd like to get a copy of it, and my place been copying some of it. I've got quite a number of reports on the battle and what led up to it from different viewpoints.
Mm.
But they're like everything else in history, they don't agree, they all have different stories.
Mm.
They don't even agree how many was killed up here, soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Do the Indians have any story of it in their culture?
Well, I talked to Chief Two Bears quite a bit on it, and all the story they have is what they have been told, you see. He's a grandson of the chief that took part in the battle. And I don't know, it's one thing has been told for two or three generations, mm-hmm. It's a lot too. And then we have one thing that's pretty good that we have is there was a Reverend Bede that was out among the Indians for years, and he learned the language. And he has written the story up from the Indian viewpoint as he got it from the Indians in a kind of a form of a drama.
Oh.
And that's, it's pretty good. He's got a love story connected with it, and it's about as nice a love story as I've read anybody has written. And that's quoted from the Indians. Yeah, he's just,
what's all that?
Huh?
What's all that written there? Is that what you studied?
This old man Shimon, that was up here, was quite a collector and quite a historical minded man. And he wrote, after he got old and couldn't do anything else, he had kept notes, and he had traveled quite a lot around and had notebooks. And he wrote up a history of his experience, history for each of the children, typed up and And he picked out some of it and gave to me things that I might be interested in. He said, I pissed him in this book.
Oh,
that
looks
and other stuff
that.
I've collected along those lines. I got this here somewhere in here.
Was this play ever put on?
I don't know if it was. Is it dedicated to the Dickey County people of the Committee on the Battlefield?
Where is this museum that you have?
It's about 15 miles north of here. I've got pictures of it here. And
is that right on the battlefield?
It's supposed to be. But it's like all other historical facts. There's nothing sure about for the battlefield place there. There's lots of evidence that the battle covered a lot of ground, even in this country here. And I recorded all that evidence that I found and the stories of the old people of what they found here. I got that here. So if somebody's interested later on, they can. Yeah, I got a sketch of things that has been found.
Oh.
And that was used part of it in that battle. There was, you know, that it's a very dry year, according to Sully's report, and they had about 75 wagons and probably 1,500 horses in their army cavalry. And they, it was dry and not much grass, and they were going short of feed for the horses. And after the battle here, of course, they'd used up their supplies, and they didn't need so many wagons, and they discarded a bunch of the wagons, according to his story. Well, I know the spot where the early settlers found the iron for 15 wagons that had been burned right south, west of here.
He's down a path.
And near there was a hunter who lived at the foothill. But he's a blacksmith, knew his name was Banks. Found a rifle in pretty good shape. And he was in here probably 15 years after the battle. And we had that rifle up at the battlefield, but somebody stole it. And the, I can't find it, it's in here somewhere. And the State Historical Society located another one just like it, so we got one that looks just like it.
What was the evidence that led them to the center of the battlefield up there then? In the land of Texas, wagons were found down.
I got the story by the fellow that saw that. Well, at first, you know, they picked up buffalo bones in the country. That is, there's a big market for buffalo.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, some fellows went out there and picked bones, and they found a lot of bones down there, and human skulls somewhere. Human bones. And that was to, got noised around, and I got a letter written by a fellow in the East. Now I guess he's a professor. He was up there the day afterwards, and he tells us that he found no buffalo bones there, but mule bones and horse bones and human bones. And that led them to believe that that's the battle that took place there.
Mm-hmm.
And they got, Sully kept the record of how far he traveled each day and about the direction he went. And they found a place about 9 miles from this battlefield where there were some guns and stuff and looked like that an army had camped there and departed in a hurry. They left quite loud, so the settlers found it there. And they figured that's what Sully calls his camp number 33, and that was where he had gone into camp at night in the evening. And they all agreed that they rode on, they took their horses up after supper and rode to the battlefield in about an hour where the battle took place. And this would be about correct according to that.
Mm-hmm.
And these were just hunters, these men that they had battle with. I mean, they were not...
They were a bunch of hunters that had, the Indians didn't have winter quarters here. They had winter quarters on the Missouri River in woods there. And they had a hunting expedition. They came out here and put a buffalo meat and pemmican. And according to the reports, there was carloads that they had with them there, pemmican. And evidently they were on the way home with their season's food supply. And in this gulch shelter here, that is an ideal place for hunting buffalo, the way they hunted, and it's deep on the south, and it's kind of a flat ground. When the settlers came, they found an awful lot of buffalo bones that they hauled out of there a long time. That's the story. That's so many times that, and it's not out so.
Was it on the buffalo trail or something there?
That is, here was the wild buffalo country.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been hunting, and they were on their way back to their winter lodges.
and the army attacked them then, just without provocation?
Well, according to the general's story, General Sully was acquainted here. He knew of this hunting ground. He was stationed at Fort Peel when that was first established in 1852 as a captain, this General Sully. And he knew the Indians and the Indian country, and that's why he was sent up here, I suppose, to Corral by Lincoln. And he come up the Missouri River as far as he could with his boats, and then he took the land, and he traveled from a point about 30 miles north of Pier to Long Lake up to Post Bismarck,
mm-hmm.
along the river there, didn't find any Indians. And he was to meet Sibley. Sully had been delayed, and Sibley had a skirmish with the Indians there, and then took back across the country to Fort Snelling. So he never mentioned it. When he got up to Long Lake, they scouted around and didn't, he hadn't found any Indians, only some stragglers. And so he took a line towards the hunting ground that he was acquainted with here, see, from Long Lake. I got it drawn up here. And then the last day he knew he was approaching the hunting grounds, he had House, his subordinate, with 300 men off to his right about 6 miles marched. And towards evening, House with his 300 men marched right into this Indian camp. Sully had missed it. He was west with his outfit. And it was towards evening when when House discovered the Indians, and he sent scouts back to Sully's camp, and they had gone into camp for the evening already. And by the time the army got to where the Indians were, it was just about sundown. And according to Sully's reports, he never gave orders to fire, and I don't think he intended to shoot. But the men were so eager to. They didn't find any Indians to come up here to kill Indians, and they just went to shoot me without orders. There are two different ones telling that. Sully was conferring with the chiefs and taking prisoners. He didn't give orders to shoot.
Mm-hmm. That sounds quite probable. That
from one story that one fellow had written, how the shooting started, he said an Indian comes towards them and wrapped in a flag of truce, an American flag, I guess, or was it a white flag? And there was a Dutchman in the group that was a crack shot, and he took a shot at him and killed him. And then the shooting started.
Mm-hmm.
And then Furness was the commander on one side. Sully came down to the center. House was on the north side, and Furness on the south side, 300 men apiece. And he reports that his men started shooting in our order.
I suppose they were all Minnesota men, too.
Mostly Nebraska and Iowa.
Oh, I thought maybe they were angry because of the Minnesota massacre.
Well,
see,
they
this
were
the year after
angry
that.
Because of the. They were sent out here. The story that came to Lincoln was that the Indians were preparing for another outbreak, and there were many of the soldiers became restless on that account, and that's why he sent this expedition back to Lincoln. But that story has been circulated without foundation by the fur companies and by those that
mm-hmm.
were trying to make all the trouble for Lincoln they could.
What year was that, Millie?
1863.
Oh.
The Minnesota massacre took place in 62.
Yeah.
Mm. And they claimed there were some of the men, some of the Indians had taken part in the Minnesota massacre, and that's likely, you see, they got away from that up here. And you're writing history, you know how mistakes are made and how things don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is, they got a bunch of soldiers supposed to be buried under the monument there.
awful.
And there isn't sufficient proof to satisfy me that they were, and they were soldiers. Found some bones and buried them there. But there's a bunch of soldiers supposed to be buried somewhere, and only part of them have been found.
How many were killed in the of the white men?
I think 21 or 2.
And how many Indians did they kill?
Oh, the different estimates, probably 200 or something like that.
A lot of them are women and children, according to this, were they? I mean, did they have women and children with them?
Oh, yeah. Well, they when they went on their hunting expedition, that carries out the helps to make it a better story. The Indians, when they went on these hunting expeditions, they left the young people and the old people and the cripples home in the winter lodges, those that were not able to take active part in the hunt. And the babies they took along, and young people big enough to help with the hunt.
And the mothers.
And the mothers. Well, they don't record anything but babies. They picked up a lot of babies. And they shot babies. When they broke up camp, the Indian mothers strapped the babies to their dogs, some of them. And the next morning, the Indians were gone. You know, they killed some and drove the rest away. And these dogs were around the camp carrying babies strapped to them, running all over the hills. And they started shooting the dogs to rescue the babies. And sometimes, of course, they shoot the babies. And they took away a couple of loads of babies, took a lot of babies along with them. And some of them give up to be men and women.
Oh.
And there was an old lady, the T. Two Bears had told about her.
Oh, yeah.
I imagine she's dead now.
Yes, I would have remembered.
She was found on the battlefield the next morning nursing her dead mother. She grew up to be an old woman, and she were to be here at the battlefield at a certain time, but she was unable to come to us as well.
The white man's a curious animal, isn't he? He carries on a massacre like this, and then he makes a museum to the people that he's destroyed.
Yeah.
Well, we've got something up here. We've got a plaque dedicated to the Indians on this battlefield. I don't think they got that on very many of them.
No. That's fine. This
looks
like an interesting
poem. That is supposed to be an Indian love story that he's kind of worked into that thing, and it's about as nice a love story as ever, right?
Can I keep this out? I'll read it tonight. No.
Yeah.
I'd like to read that long history there you've got, too.
Right? Well, that's written by Tom Shinman, the story of the early days here. Different stories.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Very soon.
Were you born around here?
Yeah, I was born near Frederick, about 35 miles from here. 1885.
Did your family homestead here?
Yeah, I homestead here in 1907.
Oh, and one of the later.
You were born in 85, were you?
Yeah.
But your father.
Here is the unveiling of the plaque. We had the Indians there, that is dedicated to the Indians.
What did you say?
I say your father.
My father came in there before the railroad hit Aberdeen and homesteaded it.
Yeah,
he walked from Wabay, South Dakota, to his homestead in 80. That is in the spring of 82. Then the railroad reached, but the trains didn't run farther than Ball Bay. They had track left to Aberdeen, but they didn't run trains. And then they built up as far as Elmdale in 82. And he came up here in Saturday in 83.
Did you know this Chief Two Bears well? I mean, can you get to know an Indian like that well? I mean, you know, so you talk freely?
Oh, yes, he talks very freely. Oh, I don't know him too well. I met him at different times, and I had the longest talk with him. We were going to have some doings up there one time, and the Indians were supposed to come to Allendale
and the committee, Battlefield Committee, was to meet him there and entertain him in the afternoon. And I was thrashing and I didn't have time to rain, but I thought I'd go in the evening. And the Indians hadn't got there, and the rest of the committee had left except Attorney Graham. He lived in Ellendale, so I looked around, and when I was just ready to leave home, it's after dark here, the Indians drove in, they had cardboard. So then I took him to supper, and I told Graham about it, and we made supper for him. And when we was waiting for the steaks, you know, we were waiting for the steak, I asked him if they cared for a bottle of beer. There was just two of them, Cane Tape, two bears, and a minister, Indian minister. Yeah, they'd like a bottle of beer, so I asked the rest of them if he'd go and get us a beer then. And we had supper, and then we got the room, and then Graham came, and he brought a down the line. So we went up to their room and we visited there way after midnight to get their stories, since they had them. Now, the story that led to the Minnesota massacre, you mentioned something about a hen's nest in your history.
Mm-hmm.
The Indians stopped at a certain place to get something to eat, and they danced around destroying the hen's nest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had that story.
They did.
And but it was a little different. And they had quite a few stories that led to the Minnesota massacre, and that's what led to this trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But these were friendly Indians. They insisted, and I think they were. They were just people.
Mm-hmm.
And but their stories is not a superstition connected to the Minnesota. They haven't preserved much. This lead there has lived with him a long time, and he's got about more than I could get out of him, of course, in a few hours.
Mm-hmm. Were they bitter in their telling about it, or did they feel bitter?
Well, they feel bitter at the heart, but they don't try to express that.
Mm.
At that time, that's some years ago now, and was it Wilson's inauguration? When they, or was it Roosevelt, when they had the big Indian powwow, the politician brought the Indians in to put on a demonstration in Washington. And the chief two-bag was in on it, the whole group from out here, and was told how he was treated. They treated him nothing.
He did?
They were supposed to take care of him and pay the rain and everything, and they got him down to Washington, and they found themselves even short of food. And they went to a Negro restaurant there, they got better treatment than anywhere else. And they had to beg their way home.
They did?
Good God, isn't that something?
And he was pretty bitter about that.
Hmm.
But we have about 6-7 miles southwest of here, there's a large boulder. It's, we got photographs of it. It's quite large. And there's some sculpture work on it. There's the face of a buffalo and buffalo tracks, and then there's what might be a mat. And it's up on a high place, it can be seen from a long distance. And if the Indians came from the towards the Black Hills this way, it would point to this hunting ground.
Oh.
And I asked them about that monument, if they had any tradition of that monument. And he didn't know anything about this one, but he knew of some others. And then I asked them if they had any stories or any tradition when or how they happened to do that work.
Well, he said the ants did that work for men, to guide men to the hunting ground. No, I didn't get what he meant by ants, what he meant the insect, or he had the, or if they were some kind of superhuman, but he said the ants did that. People. That was to guide them to a good hunting ground. And that's what the only reason this rock has been sculpted, I think, is the buffalo tracks over the rock points towards this hunting ground. This here was the center of the good hunting ground. Without question, I feel this is the roughest field. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was Two Bears a Dakota Indian? Two Bears, he was a Dakota Indian.
These are Sioux. He was a grandson of the chief Two Bears that was chief at the time in the study.
Oh, I know. That's the guy's picture here.
But he's he drinks heavy, and I think he's a fellow that would do most anything for a dollar.
He's still alive?
As far as I know, he is. But he's sociable fellow, and he was all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd sure like to see this in winter, that long span of...
...anything to be of any value. I regard them as mileposts or something to go by, but leaders without movement behind them, I don't think we've had any that is any value to us.
Well, it's impossible to conceive.
Many do, but some, like your dad, and many I could name, never forgot that. One was to feel that the leaders are the importance, all the hullabaloo, you know, we hear now about the leaders of the Soviet Union, they predict this and that with regards to leaders. Well, as far as the leaders, to me, they represent public opinion, they must. And they are not the important part of the movement.
No, they're...
Yeah, well, they totally did. And he ended up in nothing.
Yeah, they go right, are thrown back into the abyss.
Of course, when they felt they haven't been recognized to the extent they should have, they were regarded themselves as the whole movement, and then they, as the people move on, they can't follow, and they become disappointed, and they turn against the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a sad.
Follows all the time to such an extent, it's hard to get away from.
Yeah, the leaders.
From Massachusetts, what's his name, has written now on that question. They were and so forth, but not like Webster, I think he is way, way off.
Oh, you know,
a slave of the capitalists of the time.
Webster.
Yes, and he makes a hero out of him. I can't see whether he has any hero. He was one of these unbending guys that, he had his own ideas, and I don't think he cared too much for the people or served the people. He was very hard, and the farmer lines was the movement, and they had farmer lines meetings quite often, and I remember them.
When you were a kid?
Yeah, when the kids became interested, because it promised something better, you know. We all felt that.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling among the people were such that it...
What do you remember about?
Well, I remember mostly, I was pretty young. I don't remember much details of what they fought for, but I remember mostly the enthusiasm of the people.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once I was at, went with my dad to a Farmer Alliance meeting some distance from home. And there was a secret organization, and I remember he had to give his password to get through the door. And I could see a picture of the chairman, great big Dutchman, and knowing the enthusiasm and how he's pounding the desk and how everybody were, the enthusiasm, the whole crowd has had effect on the kids.
Mm-hmm.
That was a secret organization, the Farmers Alliance.
Yeah, it was organized like a lot. Well, those the early labor organizations and the Grange, and they were all had the password and were semi-secret organizations.
Like a lodge.
Yeah, I suppose it was because of the opposition. Whoever belonged to them, for instance, the Knights of Labor was a secret organization, something like a lodge.
Well, the Farmers Union too organized on that basis too at first.
I guess at first.
They had to have a password. I guess we never did in our locals, I don't think, but I see in there.
Well, the Farmers Union is quite an old organization, you know, down from the south of Texas.
And the bylaws or something.
They were all a secret.
Well, was that just because
Knights of Labor?
Yeah,
you know, they were boycotted and persecuted.
Mm-hmm. But the farmers.
It's some credit, and if it was known that they belonged to some organization, they would be blacklisted.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead and tell about your.
When the people lived under very tough conditions, they poor crops, you know, they didn't have much ground growth, and living was very. Not much to eat and not much of anything.
Did you work hard when you were young? Did you work in the fields?
Yes, we had to work. Everybody worked then from the time they were able to do anything, you know, do something.
How many were in your family?
And there was three boys and three girls. All the neighbors there lived in little shacks. One-room shacks, most of them. But there was a lot of sociability, Sunday dinners, and more so than now. You know,
mm-hmm.
They mixed a lot. I think they had just more good times than they are now.
Mm-hmm. What did the children do?
I don't remember anything. They weren't allowed to dance or play cards or anything. They were very religious.
Oh, they were religious.
Oh, yes. They came together. They were all religious, but there were so many denominations that they had often a time organizing a church there. Everyone thought they belonged to the right ones.
Mm-hmm.
They were all Lutherans, but anyway, there was such controversy between them that they had not a time organizing a church. But they finally got it organized.
All together?
Oh, yes.
What was their common?
And they. And preachers, ministers would come in and try to organize them of different denominations, and everyone was convinced that he was the right, had the right slant of things, you know, and that made things worse. You understand now, I didn't then. We lived in a community of Norwegians. To the south of us was a community of Germans. To the north of us was a Finnish community. The Finns emigrated there in a group from Finland because they come in there through an agent that was connected with the Milwaukee Railroad Company and located a large settlement. And there was no connection between these settlements. They didn't associate. They even thought the other wasn't to be associated with, you know, the Finns, they wasn't right, and the Germans, they wasn't right. Same way, the Germans were better fixed. They put up good buildings. They had farmed most of them east before they came there, where their folks had, and they looked more prosperous, but when the hard times come, they were just as hard as anybody else. And what I've been trying to find out, that's a conundrum to me, how they could organize as much as they did in those times with the means they had. They organized this firm alliance. That brought them all together. They all got into that. They couldn't talk to each other. None of them spoke very much English, but they got along in those organizations. That firmer alliance kind of welded the communities together.
Hmm.
And it spread education and the
then began to get acquainted with each other, there's different communities, and began to realize that there were people living in those other settlements too. That was a great boost right there that that organization gave to the country, besides the economic help they got from it.
Did that?
But I can remember that they fought for were to force the railroad companies to finish boxcars or sites to build warehouses on to sell the grain. The railroad company was in cahoots with the grain companies, and there was no other way to dispose of the grain to sell it to the warehouses in town, and they graded their grain down to tremendously. They got now before they had the best grain in the world. And I got different historical proof for that fight for sites to build elevators, and they wanted loading platforms, and they wanted the railroad to furnish cars so they could load their grain themselves and ship it. Well, that's one of the great demands. And they wanted the senators elected by the people, because they realized that they had to have a voice in Washington, and the senators were elected by the state legislatures, then by the politicians. And each state has two senators, and the large states has many representatives, and they figured that the western states would have more votes in Congress if they could elect the senators by the people. That was one of the big demands. Another demand that I remember that wasn't so important, but yet it was too, they wanted a parcel post system in our grade. And I remember when they began to receive catalogs from these catalog houses being organized, and the things were so much cheaper than they could buy them in town that they couldn't hardly believe it. So they would gather in the community gatherings to make up a freight order for goods. They didn't have much money, but they would buy things that way. That it wouldn't be practical to send by express or by freight to each other. They wanted parcel posts so that they could have access to this purchasing. Yeah. Those are the three demands I can remember that wasn't very much talked about.
Mm-hmm.
The South, they had a big farmer alliance in the South. And the farmer alliance was that we were connected with started in Minnesota, grew out of the grain.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
The kind of cooperative purchasing organization, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And they began to realize, and they were in the grains, it's against their constitution to discuss politics or religion within the grain meetings. But they urged people to become active in politics. They were parties of their choice. But they come to a conclusion, a great number of them, that they had to become active in politics, and they had to have a political organization in order to win the demands permanently, because if they did make gains by their cooperative setups, if they couldn't have a voice in making the laws, those gains would be lost again. The history that I've got a hold of the populists was this: the Farmer Alliance of the North was the ones that made the initiative and called it a national meeting and invited labor organizations and farm organizations. And I've got a map here, but I should know they don't know. And my idea was to, I've been working on, is to make a map that you could explain in an evening to a group of people,
mm-hmm.
and give them idea of the trends of things. Said twice, at two different times, and both times it made quite a little impression on people that hadn't had any interest in it, because
mm-hmm.
they talked about it afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats, the Democrats in New York split up into two groups. That was way back in 1845. They split up into what they call the honkers and the barn burners.
Yeah.
Well, the honkers, they
I suppose they named them because they talked about things and didn't do anything, and the barn burners or something actually did something. They protested against the rent of the big estates in New York, and maybe they burned some barns, I don't know. Anyway, they were called the barn burners. Well, then we had a little free soil party. It's a party of the people. And these barn burners and free soil finally got together and elected 10 men to Congress. And after a little while, they organized into the Republican Party. And they were the foundation of the Republican Party. And elected Lincoln.
No, I don't know. I never heard that.
Well, I can't find any trace of the early Marxist in anything that I have available. But I know that Marx wrote in Greeley's paper, and he also corresponded some with Lincoln. And I would like awful well to be able to read that correspondence, if anything. Now, here's one thing. With I've read a lot of Marxist literature, a lot of writers that I get disgusted with. They make a lot of claims they can't substantiate, and I can't see any benefit in that.
No.
I want facts. And the only facts that we could find, Robert Owen made a big contribution. We could find a trace of that all the way down the line, a thread going all the way down, both in labor and in farmers' organizations. And but as far as I know, there was contribution by the Marxists, and there were Marxists here, or half-baked Marxists. I don't know what they were in the early days. But I haven't anything where I can really find just what contributions they made. I'm not religious, but I'm centered in the history of religion. And after the war was won, Commissioner of Agriculture sent out some people to invest the condition among the farmers in the south and also in the northwest. And one of these by the name of Kelly, and a fellow by the name of Saunders went out and come back with the ideas that the farmers needed an organization and they needed to protect them through their own efforts. And they got together and started the Grange. And I think that was Lincoln's appointed Commissioner of Agriculture. Lincoln then had died, you see. He was shot, but he didn't get it through. But it was his appointees that started the Grange. First Grange in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And that Grange was a very influential organization and a far-reaching organization. And
They said they were non-political.
Yeah. He wrote a book that I'd like to read, but as far as I know, there's one copy in the Minnesota Historical Society. I don't know whether there's any more copies available now or not.
I'll see if I can... You haven't read it?
No.
Yeah.
The workers in their organization and the farm organization, they had battled for a free homestead for years and years and years. And this Free Soil Party, their family organized to combat slavery of all forms. They were for free homestead, and when Lincoln ran for president the second time, he was defeated the first time. You see, anyway, the Republican Party came to power about 10 years after they were organized. They had a slogan, "I'll vote yourself a farm." And that took with the common people, you know. And I give that slogan a lot of credit for electing Lincoln, because Lincoln had a lot of obstacles to surmount that, to regain that president.
Yeah.
And I figured that little Free Soil Party had so much a bunch of notes connected that I wrote and put together, and we got a copy of it. If you would take time to read that while I'm looking to look through it, I got it set down.
Yeah, I'd like to.
I
I sent a copy to Knudsen the other day for him to read and comment on. Jonathan, Sheehan, and Martha does a little typing, and they worked at the typing. And you got another copy here. It isn't quite as good as the one we sent to Knudsen, but you can look through it and
yes, I
get
will.
The idea of it.
Mm-hmm.
All I ever hope to do is to, I think it is something worthwhile. It's something that people need, a history of this kind.
Mm-hmm.
Eliminate wars and fights between individuals and stuff, and just show the people's movement how one graduates into another. Bernard Torkelson, he's quite a liberal, and he's quite a fellow. I discuss communism with him quite a lot, and he don't accept that, but he isn't the violence anymore. He was here and looked it over one time.
Oh, just such a short time.
Short time that he didn't get through much.
He just stopped here.
He's working for the GTA.
Mm-hmm.
On his way to another appointment, that he had to be there at 6 o'clock. So in the afternoon, he came. We haven't heard from him since.
And if I could get enough together, I feel that I know what the people need. And if we could bring enough facts before the people so they had got an understanding of how these things happen, they would at least some of them look for more facts.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow, the head person has to be careful not to exaggerate anything and make it too rosy. I like to make it just exactly as near as it happened, as near as I can.
Yeah.
Even on both sides, for or against what I want.
Yeah.
I used to read a lot of religion. And I always remember Paul. Paul, I regard as the fellow that falsified the Christian philosophy.
No, I agree with you there. Yeah.
Do you? And, you know, he was accused by the other apostle of being a damn liar, just about to bring it up, and so on, especially in James. And he answers by saying that if by my lie I have enhanced the glory of the Lord, why, yes, you might be judged as a sinner. That always comes to my mind. If by my lie I have enhanced the glory of the Lord, why yet should I be judged as a sinner? I can show you that, right?
Uh-huh.
No, then you're good anywhere. And
no.
Propaganda is lies. Well, these facts, if you stick to facts, this isn't enough. We've got to cover these facts in order to make them acceptable, make them worth something. So, well, I remember, I read him the Tidyman again this year. This British art critic, a great writer.
What?
Lord, he wrote such wonderful English. Now, I don't know much about English, but it's almost like poetry writing stuff, whatever he writes about. It's wonderful. It's just almost like music. And I used to read him an awful lot.
Who is that? Yeah.
Because he says that the thing he tried to convince the people was lost to his beautiful English. Himself, that he knew he wrote good English and beautiful English, and the people became so interested in his English that he didn't take interest in the idea he was trying to convey. When we homesteaded up here, there was three of us homesteaded together, and one of them was a newcomer from Norway, had some education. I had no education at all. But the other fellow was Swede, and he's kind of quite a thinker, and he had some schooling. And we used to get together and trash out everything. And this Norwegian was learning English, you know. And all he could see was the beauty and the style and the language in anything he wrote, he read. Now, for instance, Ibsen's and the Norwegian writers, he could know them all by heart. Or he could quote at length from those writers. Well, I don't
get a kick out of the beautiful language because they don't understand, but I look for the moral than the what they teach us. I would like to see what I'd like to convey my ideas, and I've got to convey them in a manner so the other person could get them. The other people who can fit here too got no English. Get the dates and the stuff, and they could get to the, by Charles Edward Russell, by Burdick, and some of these fellows that was in the league, and they don't even agree on dates.
No.
You know, I can read a whole book and just get a few pages of notes. It's mostly words that doesn't convey anything.
That's true.
Railroads into granting sites for elevators and furnishing car to farmers, because the Populist Party asked for nationalization of railroads. And without any preliminary, and just like it just happened, you know, in a few months, they elected 5 or 6 governors and got a large national support, and that scared the railroads, and after that they began to furnish cars to farmers to ship their grain, and sites to build warehouses on. And this Laux, after they started the cooperative movement in North Dakota, then they found that they didn't get justice at the terminal in Minnesota, Minneapolis. So they organized, they tried to organize a commission firm of their own. And this A.C.L. Laux was a member of that board. And when they got to Minneapolis, of course, they couldn't get in on anything like that. And so they made a deal with a commission for McKinnon and Company to handle their stuff on the Board of Trade. And that was just a made-up scheme. McKinnon handled their stuff for a little while and went broke. And there was 12 carloads of wheat that was lost in the fracas, and this A.C.L. Laux and the rest of the directors paid the farmers for that wheat.
Hmm.
And that broke him. Built a terminal elevator some years afterwards. He was invited to make the main speech when they dedicated the terminal elevator in St. Paul. You've seen that square building there. That's the first one they built. And so he has quite a history. And in 1920s, I corresponded with Laux. He was an old man then. And I wanted to, we had the experience of organizing the Nonpartisan League then. And it looked so impossible to me how they were able to organize the Farmers' Alliance to the extent they did with the means they had then. There was no way to get around. Oxen, you know, and a few horses, and no way to get around. And I wrote to him, corresponded with him, trying to get some history on that, how they accomplished that thing, how they were able to organize such a movement, and how they did it. But by that time, it becomes such a money crank, he writes you pages on the money question, and he didn't answer the what I really wanted to know. So I didn't get any information out of him. He's pretty old then. But that would have been valuable information,
mm-hmm.
just how they went about it, see. But as far as I get it, it's mostly by correspondence. But they organized it. Many communities was the same. There were Norwegians and Finns and Germans, and they couldn't speak to each other. They didn't speak to each other as much, and they didn't associate with each other.
Yet they came together on this.
Yes, they got together in that Farm Alliance. Now that's a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to try to dig up just how they did it. They built the community.
Mm-hmm.
And the contribution, I can see it now, to the people of the Dakotas, outside of the economic gains that they made, mm-hmm. they won all those, 3 of those demands that I remember they had. Some years later, but the contribution they made to the society was of equal value or more. He built the communities, it amalgamated the people into a group.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, that's what culture is,
yeah.
is bringing people together for an expression of I know in one article I read that called the Populist Party the singing movement. The singing picnic.
What about singing?
Well,
I haven't found anything how that got into being either. And there was difference between the two on the Negro question.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally got together.
Hmm.
But how that made it into the Populist Party. Then they had what they call the Wheel in Arkansas, a movement there. The agricultural wheel. And they had several of those movements must have grown up spontaneously, more or less, like the farmer alliance, because of the needs of the people in different communities.
Mm-hmm.
There was many of them. It was quite a press at that time, but I don't think any of it has been preserved. I read that with the purpose of getting all the facts that would help me. I didn't find very many.
And he does.
Did
you have a book on it, or did you have?
Yeah, I read one of his books and took notes.
Yeah.
There was the anti-pass fight in North Dakota. There was a time when all legislators got passes on the railroads to take a free trip and wherever they wanted while they were elected, after they were elected, and they had quite a fight in North Dakota to get rid of that because the railroads was running the state and the legislators. Another man that was in the legislature at the same time that I knew well, that had a pretty good memory and told the things, told the same story. Now there was quite an influential man that was in favor of eliminating these passes, and they thought they had to clear him in order to win. And they lost anyway. And they framed him. He was a very nice man, well-liked, had a good reputation. But they hired a woman to go into his room, see. And he came into his room, she dropped all her clothes off, and they were there to take a picture of him and with this woman.
Oh, yeah.
You read that probably. In order to shut him up, see, they had this leverage on him. But, And Burdick took up his fight on that score, and he rendered quite a service there. You know. It shows what length he would go to, you know. This old grandma. I tell you one experience I had with Bordicky. In the holiday days, we had a meeting in Bismarck, and the meeting was over. The next day, we were all going home, and there was a old Scotsman living out of Bismarck West who were to be evicted that day. Next day, so we stayed over to battle that eviction. And Burdick and I and a man by the name of Pearson was put on a committee to go before Judge Ansonius in Bismarck and try to stay this thing, see, on some grounds we had. And next morning Burdick wasn't to be found. But he sent a lengthy legal opinion up to Jansonius, and I and Pearson went up there and told him what we were, and we couldn't find Burdick. They hadn't found him. And, the judge was nice, but he wants to see Burdick. And he says he'd find him. And that guy, he brought Burdick up there, and Burdick didn't have much to say for himself, and he didn't, we put up our argument before the judge, and he listened to us, and he was nice to us, and they stayed the conviction. But Burdick, I guess he wanted him to appear, to show up there, but there was argument that he did.
Married off. Second time he lived on by the state line now.
Oh.
And then I was acquainted with his sister, and she was cooking, she was going to cook for the fashion crew for
it. I used to run the dressing outfit for 7 years. She was the cook car, then the crew, you know.
Oh, I know.
So
she cooked the cook car.
So the sister.
And I liked her cooking, so.
Well, I'm coming out for that. So they came and got me, he had an old, was it the car, that car you had?
Model T? Oh, Buick.
Old white Buick?
Yeah,
oh, yeah.